from WHYY in Philadelphia. This is the Radio Times Memorial Day special. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Today on the show, we're going to bring you three different conversations about war and those who have served. We'll hear from poet Elise Fenton. In 2010, she won the prestigious Dylan Thomas Prize for her collection of poems called Clamor. Much of her work was inspired by her husband's experience serving as a medic in Iraq. We'll also talk with Marine and Army veteran Michael Miller and retired Air Force Staff Sergeant Jacinta Johnson to get their thoughts on how to bridge the military-civilian divide. They joined us alongside Wyndon Rowe, a counselor who specializes in PTSD. But first, we're joined by historian Thomas Childers about some of the myths about World War II veterans. His book is Soldier from the War Returning. That's all coming up after the news. This is the Radio Times Memorial Day special. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us today. We're spending today's show discussing the men and women who served in the military and to commemorate those who lost their lives in combat. We begin with World War II and the common myths about the servicemen who returned from that war. Despite the positive, upbeat image of these veterans, the truth is many of them suffered from undiagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder, which led to alcoholism, unemployment, and even homelessness. University of Pennsylvania historian Thomas Childers wrote about his research into the painful stories of World War II vets in his book, Soldier from the War Returning. Let's listen. Was this a difficult book to write? And I ask that in part because the stories in here are difficult to read, but also because you are piercing some of these myths today about World War II.
Yes. I'd say the emotional toll on me just writing it was considerable, partly because it's dealing with my family, my parents, the parents of my best friend, Willis Allen and Grace Allen. These are very personal stories. I once asked Stephen Ambrose if he'd ever considered writing a book about what happened when these guys came home. There's no question about the great heroism and their achievements of this greatest generation. But there was almost nothing, as I began to discover, written about what happened when they actually got back. And Ambrose said, well, that would just be too personal, wouldn't it? And he also said, and there was also, it's not the same dramatic arc as you find with sort of combat narratives. Well, the first part of that's true. I'm not convinced that the second part is.
But we shouldn't be surprised to think that veterans, men and women, coming back from the war didn't struggle in the 1940s and 50s, didn't have to deal with some of the horror that they dealt with on the battlefield.
Well, that's right. This is a lesson that we apparently have to keep learning. I think there was an assumption that has grown up since the 70s that all of these things, post-traumatic stress disorder, shattered personal relationships, substance abuse, and so on, were somehow uniquely products of the Vietnam War. Bad war, bad outcome, bad after effects. And then, lo and behold, we have to discover that that in contrast to the Second World War, where people apparently had come back happy, well-adjusted, and so on. Now we discover, of course, all over again, with the Gulf War and with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that these problems that we saw in Vietnam are very much with us now. And as I discovered doing the book, were very much present after the Second World War.
So is it a mistake to call World War II the good war, thinking that there was then the good decade that followed the war?
Well, I think when Studs Terkel really coined that term, he put it in quotation marks. It's certainly good in contrast. Well, it was seen as a necessary war. I don't think anybody could argue that defeating Nazi Germany and the militarism of Imperial Japan was not something that had to be done. But I think, as Paul Fussell here in Philadelphia has pointed out many times, because the objectives of the war were necessary, good, sometimes even noble, that doesn't mean that the actual experience of fighting it was. It's interesting if one looks, as I did, at the media from the immediate post-war years, 45, 46, 47, 48, and so on. You don't see any of this greatest generation sort of notion. There is a lot of anxiety and worry about what was going to happen when these guys came home. Fear of a crime wave, that these guys had been brutalized by combat, that they, even if they hadn't been in combat, they'd been away from civilizing influences such as home and family for 1 year, 2, 3, 4 years. Who knew what to expect? Yeah.
And these were popular magazines like Good Housekeeping or Reader's Digest. These were not psychological journals. This is what the public was reading.
That's right. Well, you can certainly find it in psychological journals, though I suspect not very many people were reading them. But certainly in Good Housekeeping, Ladies' Home Journal, Collier, Saturday Evening Post, Reader's Digest, there was a tidal wave of articles about how to deal with him when he comes home. Will he be changed? Will he be nervous? Will he be distant. One of my favorite article titles was from Ladies' Home Journal from 47, I believe, called Peace, It's a Problem, about the difficulties of husband and wife getting to know one another, raising a family, and so on.
And I do want to talk about some more about what this book is about, but how do you understand the kind of amnesia this country seems to have about aftermaths of war, or particularly this particular war?
Well, I think this particular war is somewhat unique in that regard. I think nobody would make that argument about Vietnam. There is a mountain of literature, films, television programs, and so on about the veteran who can't readjust, the psychotic veteran. I'm not at all convinced, by the way, I can't prove this. I'm not at all convinced that Vietnam veterans, that a greater percentage of Vietnam veterans had more trouble than World War II veterans. But at the end of the Second World War, the greatest generation, these men had many great qualities. Being frank and open about their feelings, I think, speaking as a son of one of them, was probably not their greatest strength. And also the culture. It was the Hemingway society. Men kept their mouth shut. They suffered in silence and went on. You didn't whine. You didn't complain. There's a certain amount of that still, of course, within military culture. One of the things that to me is disturbing about this whole phenomenon is a year or so ago, the RAND Corporation came out with a study called Invisible Wounds. And it was about the soldiers coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, all the sort of psychiatric problems they were having. And one of the things that it noted was that there are now all kinds of army programs, military programs to deal with this, but that they suspect that the vast majority of men and women who have these problems don't, that they rely on family or the church. And that is no different from the Second World War.
I guess it shouldn't be surprising, thinking of all these soldiers coming home after the war was over, but just the process of reentry. There weren't enough houses. There wasn't enough civilian clothing for those people returning. And also, you write about the kinds of, I guess, over time, the impatience that the civilian population had with these returning veterans.
Right. Homelessness was not a term that was in use in the immediate post-war years, but it certainly existed as a phenomenon. In 47, it was estimated that 1.3 million veterans were living either with relatives or friends or squatting one place or another. It was extremely difficult. There had been very few houses built during the Depression and even fewer during the war. So when these guys got back, even though there was the GI Bill to help buy houses, there wasn't very much available. So this is not an exaggeration. There are stories in Newsweek and Time and all the major magazines about veterans living in their cars, families living in decommissioned trolley cars, former army barracks being turned into housing for married people. There was a famous incident of a couple in New York who were sleeping in the Macy's bedroom display. As soon as the store closed, they had slipped in and then would go and sleep there. Another couple slept on a stage on Broadway after the theater had closed. A couple slept in lived in a chicken coop out in Wisconsin and washed up at a nearby gas station. Homelessness is one of the biggest complaints that one found veterans making after the war. Unemployment. One always thinks of the GI Bill, and of course, then the great takeoff of the American economy a bit later in the 40s. But in that transitional period from wartime economy to peacetime, there was a lot of unemployment, especially among veterans. These guys came back, and the unemployment rate for veterans was quite high, over three times what it was for civilians. a case of a guy who came back and went through the counseling about what jobs he was qualified for. He'd been an infantry or he'd been a Marine. And they said, well, you can be a Maine hunting guide. So a lot of skills that didn't have civilian applications.
You quote a Brigadier General Leon Johnson. He was in charge of the Army Air Force's personnel services. And this was really, as you describe, a plea to the civilian population talking about these returning soldiers. All they want is a place to live and a chance to have gainful employment consistent with their abilities and skills. Surely they're entitled to that much, and yet these are the very things that they aren't getting. This has got to change. And what I read from that was that from the civilian population, a kind of impatience about these veterans getting on with their lives and perhaps feeling that there was scarcity. And the perhaps unwillingness to scare to share some of these scarce resources.
Yeah, that's right. There is a lot, of course, of the welcome home, the banners, the great praise for the soldiers and their sacrifice. But as 45 turned to 46 and the war began to recede, well, during the war there was the saying that anybody encountered any sort of difficulty at home, you would say, "Don't you know there's a war on?" So don't complain, yeah. By 1946, what veterans frequently heard was, "The war's over, soldier." There was a very famous article in the Saturday Evening Post, the title of which was, "Are We Making a Bum Out of G.I. Joe?" And it was about how veterans were taking advantage of the G.I. Bill, one part of which was, if you could not find a job, you were guaranteed $20 a week for 52 weeks. And so it was called, cynically, the 52-20 Club. You began to get a sort of undercurrent of civilian impatience, as you said, with veterans complaining.
But as you also have made clear, while we are talking about those soldiers who struggled with reentry, there were some, and these are perhaps the ones that Tom Brokaw was writing about, there were some who were able to make that readjustment. Does anyone know why some and not the others?
The quick answer to the latter is no. Part of it has to do, obviously, with the actual experience. Part of it has to do with the psychological stability before. But attempts to sort of sort this out have not been terribly fruitful from a psychiatric point of view. Yes, one of the things I want to emphasize, and thank you for posing it this way, is that a great many people came back. They may have stumbled a little bit coming back. They may even had a touch of PTSD, whatever. And then they pulled themselves together, went on, and had very successful lives. And they've been written about, talked about, and justly praised over and over again. We know the story. The reason I wrote this book was that there seemed to me to be a great many people out there for whom this I think, true but also now romanticized view didn't apply. I would also have to say the three men that I've written about, my father, Willis Allen, Michael Gold, and their families, all three of these men were very successful people.
Interesting.
They weren't people who were somehow paralyzed by their war experiences. They went on. My father was a very successful businessman, finally. Willis Allen was a successful man. Michael Gold, as I said, was a very, very distinguished OBGYN. So the point, I think, is that a lot of beneath even the surface of these of the sort of greatest generation storyline or the arc of their lives, there is an awful lot of unresolved business.
That was my 2009 interview with University of Pennsylvania historian Thomas Childers about his book Soldier from the War Returning, The Greatest Generation's Troubled Homecoming from World War II. This is the Radio Times Memorial Day special. When we get back from our break, we'll hear about how to bridge the military-civilian divide. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Radio Times Memorial Day special. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us today. We continue our show about the men and women who serve in the armed forces with a discussion about the military-civilian divide. Those who return from combat often feel as though they can no longer relate to the family and friends they left behind who don't fully grasp what they've been through. So we talked with Michael Miller, an Army and Marine Corps veteran, retired Air Force Staff Sergeant Jacinta Johnson, and Wyndon Rowe, a counselor who specializes in PTSD. Let's take a listen. Part of the reason for doing the show is what we are describing as this civilian, military, or veteran divide. The fact that at least today, something like 1% or maybe even less percent of the population has anything to do with the military. And in many ways, we live in very different worlds. I was looking at a map, and most of our soldiers and Marines come from a handful of states. They tend to be in the South, for instance, that we don't really know each other. And so when someone says without thinking, thank you to Michael Miller, he doesn't like that. But people, but probably from a civilian perspective, they think they're doing something nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a challenging answer for me to come up with, because I kind of have like a foot in both worlds.
Right.
I'm not of the military, but I was raised in it. And I had a life experience where my dad was gone most of my life, and he was a weekend warrior, if that. I remember hearing his car pull into the driveway. I mean, I can still hear it, and being so elated to see him and know that we were going to have our father-daughter Friday afternoon ritual. And then that feeling of, you know, like my tummy dropping out and hearing him pull out of the driveway on Sunday. And the challenges that we faced in our home with him being gone so much. And at the same time, I consider myself a civilian. You know, right. I have that influence, but I did not go to boot camp. I did not serve. And so I kind of see it from both sides. And I understand, you know, and what I hear from a lot of the men and women that I work with is, and it's so interesting, there's so much humility in the military. But you don't expect it because of this sort of cultural vision of what we have of this, you know, tough guy, tough girl, soldier. But there really is such an intense softness and a quiet that exists in such a bold culture. And I think that we as American citizens want to say thank you. You know, my dad says his duty and the oath that he swore to is to protect the Constitution of the United States of America. And so when you're an American citizen, you want to say, thank you. I have freedoms. I can vote. I have the freedom of speech. And so I think that we want to express gratitude, right. But I think that we need to kind of redirect how we do that.
Well, and it does get you thinking about some of the myths, the stereotypes. As you were saying, Michael, this notion of PTSD. First of all, not everyone who serves has PTSD, and it's not like people come home and go crazy.
Yeah.
It's just there's a kind of suffering inside. Do you want to add anything to our conversation, Jacinta?
It's just interesting to listen to your perspective about how it impacted you as a child when your dad was leaving. And it kind of ties into what you were saying,
right.
During your poem.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't think about how it impacts the family as a whole. I watched my daughter change.
And we should say your husband is in the Air Force
yes.
as well.
My husband is a staff sergeant in the Air Force out at McGuire Air Force Base. And he's gone a lot.
Right.
And the first time my daughter experienced her dad leaving, she was too young to really say what she felt, so she acted out. She acted out in ways that I had never seen, and I was just like, man, who's this little girl that I'm dealing with?
Yeah.
You know, this wasn't my happy child. This was my now frustrated child, because she couldn't say, Mom, I miss Dad, you know? So people, I don't think, always understand how it affects everyone in the family. You know, for me, it was okay, because I was serving at the time. I've had to leave. There's been plenty of times where, you know, I had to say goodbye to my husband. I'll see you later. But that was prior to me having my little girl.
Sure.
So that was hard for her.
Yeah.
She can't, and she couldn't talk at that time either. So it was even harder.
Yeah. I think most people don't even realize how you have to compartmentalize the things in your life when you leave like that. It's nothing like, you know, seeing your baby with no teeth and coming back, and now the baby has, you know, a whole top drawer. You're like, well, what's going on here?
I'm not walking.
You
and
miss
not walking.
A lot of the milestones. And it's so crazy, because children are so resilient.
Mm-hmm.
They just really are. Their love doesn't change because you're not there. And that can make a person feel like a failure in a way, like I don't deserve all of this love that you give me because
as a parent,
I'm not here.
It.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you know what? We're human just like everybody else. You know what I mean? The things hurt us. We think about stuff. But the sad part about everything is you don't have time in a war zone to be, you know, worried about your family or crying about things. You know, if you're married and you have a good girl, if you have a girlfriend or whatever the case may be, you count on the people in the rear to like not bring those little problems up to you because I have to focus on this. I have to focus on getting back home. That is my job. I have to take care of the people that are sitting next to me, the people that are in front of me, regardless to what the mission is. I have to make it back. They have to make it back. We have to make it back together, you know?
There's so much I want to pick up on. One thing that you said, Wyndon, just about perhaps some of the myths and stereotypes about the military, but I was also reading that it is one, at least according to Gallup, perhaps the most trusted institution that we have in this country. People, we know how people feel about Congress. We know how they feel about the media. I mean, and there are other institutions that are also under a cloud, but it's, I think it was like 75% of the country has a very positive feeling about the military. Now, whether that's knee-jerk or whether that's heartfelt, I don't know. But it's an interesting way that the military seems to stand out as an institution.
So if we separate the politics from military involvement in the world and we just look at it as an organization and its structure, everything is the same. So you, no matter what your race, creed, gender, age, are expected to fulfill your duty as required. And in the civilian world, that does not exist at all. And it's incredibly frustrating for those of us that are so accustomed to that structure, to operate in a structureless society where, you know, Dave to my right.
I have to say, both of our the other guests are nodding their head. No, go ahead, Wyndon.
So Dave to my right can show up to a meeting 15 minutes late. And, you know, Diane to my left can be there on time and one will deliver, one will not. But there really isn't any kind of repercussion for that. In the military, that does not happen. And that actually sets the stage and the tone for there is so much diversity inside of this organization, but the expectation is the same. Mm-hmm. And so the camaraderie is really there. It's so team oriented. And here in this country, there's definitely a separation from that.
Yeah. And that's such a powerful thing. I mean, just since I'm thinking about just the power of relationships, the power of community, the power of someone who's got your back. I mean, that's something it's almost built into the military.
It is. It's very built into it. And you hold on to those relationships sometimes for dear life because you know that this man, this woman is going to have my back regardless, even on the field when you're fighting and when you're home, you know, and at the doing the regular day-to-day mission. Mm-hmm. I still to this day have some of my best friends are in the military. You know, to this day, I still speak to my last supervisor from my last duty station. He actually texted me yesterday. Hey, how you been? I haven't heard from you. Hey, I'm good. You know, so you do. You, it's just such a family.
Sure. A family.
It's a family.
That's a powerful word. You want to add anything,
yeah,
Michael?
It gets the crazy part about everything is a lot of people do. I think America does embrace the military as a whole because we're kind of ingrained in society because we're family members, we're brothers, we're sisters. You know, we outnumber Congress and things of that nature. You know, you see us everywhere doing something. And normally, if we are your friends, we are your best friend. You tell us a secret, that's going to the grave. Mm-hmm. You know, you call me at 3:30 in the morning because your tire blew out and you 20 miles away, I'm coming. You know, I will never leave you behind. The sad part is once you get out of the military, in a sense, you are kind of left behind. You know, a lot of people don't understand that as a vet. For instance, there is legislation that's supposed to be in place where if you hire a vet, you get perks and things of that nature. I had a friend on Facebook that I served with. I was in Afghanistan, but I had to send him a message because he had posted something on Facebook just saying, hey, do anybody know where there's any homeless veteran shelters? And if you follow down his timeline, you'll see he said, you know, I applied for this many jobs and I haven't gotten one, you know, and I guess most people feel good with the Dog and Pony Show, and it's a lot of stuff that could be said, but there's two types of truths. There's the truth, and then there's the truth. Nobody wants the truth, you know, they just want the truth. They want what makes them feel good.
The easy truth.
Yeah, yes. they want what makes society feels like it's working.
Flowers.
But it's broken so badly when you can go and sacrifice everything. Like, they don't realize you sacrifice your family, you know,
for
a higher calling. You do. Your health, your mental well-being. We sacrifice everything. And then when you come back and you want to do something, nobody really has answers for you.
Nope. But was it worth it for you, Michael?
For me, every single moment of it was. And if I had to do it all again, and I always tell people I would do it all again. And I had people say, well, even if you got blown up again, would you do it again? And I'm like, yeah, because you know what? When I was out there, there was plenty of my friends who felt down or something bad was going on back home. And I may have been, you know, that hand that reached back to hold them up.
Exactly.
Or I might have been the shoulders that they stood on to get through that rough period of time, as people were for me. And if I wasn't in place, what's to say that would have happened?
How about for you, Jacinda?
Yeah, without a second thought. You know, for me, I always thought that my career would be 20 or more. So for it to be cut short, it was heartbreaking because, like I said, that's my family.
Well, I'm thinking, too, a little bit about that reentry process, whether you served or whether you didn't serve, the reentry, I guess, out of the military, whether it's a base in this country or a base in another country, what that is like, and whether there are things like loneliness or just feeling that sense of being alone. You don't have that same community.
This is unofficial, but I call it like the lone wolf syndrome, I think, is a really good metaphor, that you are designed over time to be a pack animal. And then you come home and you're the only person of your kind everywhere you go. And this has a huge implication. I know University of Delaware recently reported that 50% of their incoming veteran students drop out within, and I might misquote this, but I think it's within the first year. And that's an extremely high dropout rate. So we need to look at that. These are not people that are not qualified to be students. These are people who have needs that are not being met on a community level. And so what I find really interesting about the work that I'm doing right now is that I see some vets clinically, meaning they come in for individual sessions and I help to counsel them. But a lot of the work that I'm starting to do is more almost like on a consulting level, where I help assist in the design and implementation of grassroots community-oriented programs that get all of these people in a room together, whether it's just the veteran or the veteran and their spouse or the veteran and their families, and to create some kind of platform where there's unity there, because that is clearly missing upon reentry.
When we were talking about people saying, like, thank you, like, do you think, like, somebody wants to be thanked because they had to make a choice? And I don't care what anybody says, even with the election, you hear the lesser of two evils. Let me tell you something. The lesser of two evils is still evil regardless. And when you do something and you have to live with the decisions you made, you saved a life and the life was lost. I mean, how do you rationalize that out to yourself to make yourself feel better? Because you have to wake up with you. You have to go to bed with you. You have to live with every decision that you make, even if it's a forced decision.
Wendin, I know you want to add something.
I think, you know, my field is so limited. I think that we create, and I know we're well-intended. I'm not trying to bash on the clinical world, but we create these diagnoses and we become so prescriptive in how we look at people, and we try and compartmentalize and box, and we want to check things off. And, one of my limitations is that, you know, this is so far beyond PTSD. I might work with someone who has no symptomatic expression, but they're living with what we call moral injury, which is the injurious effect of having to make those split-second decisions that you cannot reverse for the rest of your life. You might not have flashbacks. You might not be waking up in the middle of the night checking your locks, but you have that shame and that guilt and that difficult moment to constantly find some kind of peace with, and that's far beyond the diagnostic aspect of this.
Jacinta, I'm interested in the work that you do at the Veterans Multi-Service Center, the kind of people that come in and what you have learned there.
Well, we see a little bit of everything, to be honest. You see homeless. Our mission there is ending homelessness, which, you know, we are proud to say that we felt like we have. So now we offer...
In Philadelphia, right?
In Philadelphia, yes. So we offer services such as employee training, getting them the resources they need to get back on their feet. So whether that means, you know, getting them into a housing program or just something, we offer all those services. And we also offer a chance. We have two VSOs on staff. So those are veteran service officers. So if you need to come do your claim, you can also do that as well. And we're looking at getting another one. So we offer a lot of services that are there, and use them, folks, you know. Get to the VMC, the Veteran Multi-Service Center, and let us help you. So.
Is it hard, do you think, for people to ask for help?
It is. I think it's hard to ask for help because it's putting your pride aside. You know, we've been used to this culture.
It's a culture.
Yeah. We've been used to this culture for so long. And when you get out, that culture's not there anymore. So now where do you go? And a lot of us don't know where to go. And the Veteran Multi-Service Center can be that place to go.
Michael, I mentioned the fact that you're a poet. There's a piece of one of your poems I'd love to have you recite for us.
Okay. This is called The Wartime Reality Show, and I'll do a quick snippet. I normally do it with Mr. John Carr, but I understand we don't have a lot of time.
We don't, and he's sitting over here very quietly listening to all of us.
So it goes, they say that the meek shall inherit the earth, but I'm here today to tell you that the wicked gets it first. Bomb bullets and bad guys, newspapers, newscasters, political lies right now, war is the biggest reality show on TV. But you don't have to take my word for it. I mean, why believe me when you can see it for yourself? So many countries out there needing Americanized help, and our biggest and bravest are literally dying to give it. Just look at all the graveyards out there full of patriotic spirits. Or ask the children crying out for fallen fathers or mothers, but only you and your living room will ever get the chance to hear it. And the world seems to be such a lonely place for a little boy who has the I miss my daddy blues. His mother's eyes swollen with tears every time he tries on his daddy's boots, but she can't understand that he just wants to feel close to him again. So every day he goes to school and tells teachers, preachers, family, and friends, when I grow up, I want to be just like him. So when he turns 18, off he goes, another contestant for this messed up reality show.
That was my 2016 conversation with Michael Miller, Marine Corps and Army veteran, and Jacinta Johnson, retired Air Force Staff Sergeant and trauma counselor, Wyndon Rowe. You're listening to the Radio Times Memorial Day special. When we get back from the break, we'll talk with poet Elise Fenton about her poems inspired by her life as the wife of a military medic. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Memorial Day edition of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're going to close today's show about the men and women who have served in the military by talking with a poet. Dylan Thomas Prize winner Elise Fenton used her experiences as a so-called war bride as inspiration for her poetry, a collection called Clamor. It's filled with meditations on what she thought her new husband was going through as an Army medic in Iraq. She joined us in the studio a few years ago to discuss her experiences and her poetry. Let's listen. The title of your book is Clamor, and one of the poems is called Clamor. What do you mean by that? And I have to say, I even went to Wikipedia just to sort of see, what does this word clamor mean? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, well, the epigraph of the book is sort of essentially clamor, and it's the definition. And this was kind of one of those happy coincidences where I was using the word, I was using clamor. I'd used it in a number of poems before I did what I often do, which is I turned to my dictionary, and I was like, you know, I had an inkling that it meant more than what I thought. And what I discovered was it does mean noise. It means a noisy shouting, a loud continuous noise. It can mean insistent public expression, support, or protest, but the third meaning is silence. And, you know, it's one of those words that means...
both noise and silence.
Yeah, its own opposite. And so I knew, I mean, I sort of intuitively knew that this was a concept that I had been working with. And when I saw the definition, it was clear that this is, I was working with noise and silence.
Well, I'd love to have you read the poem Clamor.
Sure. Clamor. Staking fencing along the border of the spring garden, I want suddenly to say something about this word that means sound and soundlessness at once. The deafening metal of my hammer strikes wood, a tuning fork tuning my ears to a register I'm too deaf to understand. Across the yard, each petal dithers from the far pear, one white cheek at a time, like one blade of snow into the next, until the yard looks like the sound of a television screen tuned last night to late night static. White as a page or a field, where I often go to find the promise of evidence of you or your unit's safe return. But instead of footprints in the frosted static, there's only late-turned early news and the newest image of a war that can't be finished or won. And because last night I turned away from the television's promise of you, I'm still away. I've staked myself, deep to the unwrung ground, hammer humming in my hand, the screen's aborted stop time still turning over in my head, a white twist of rag pinned in the bloody center of a civilian's chest, a sign we know just enough to know it means surrender, there in the place a falling petal's heart would be.
And that's our guest, Elise Fenton, reading a poem called Clamor from her collection of poems. The book is called Clamor, and she just won the Dylan Thomas Prize. And I have to say, I love that poem, first of all, for the imagery. I mean, you go from the hammer to the pedal into the war, and then this notion of sound and silence, and included in that sound, and it seems like it's in a lot of these poems here, is the sound of the TV set, right?
Which is funny, because I didn't actually have a TV set. But I think this visual static becomes sort of sonic static.
And I would assume, you know, as someone who has a loved one who's in a war, as your husband was in Iraq, that you have this really ambivalent relationship with whether it's the TV news or the radio news or just news itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would go through. And I think this is very common. I would swing wildly between being kind of a glutton for that information and wanting nothing to do with it. And I think the one thing that I really had a hard time stepping away from was reading the names of the dead, that New York Times sort of ticker daily. Because I knew that, you know, whatever actual news was coming out, you know, I would read into it too much, or mm-hmm. I would, you know, and
of course, I mean, that seems like of course you would, right?
Yeah, and you know, and my husband was, I think he had a hard time understanding because he felt like he was relatively, you know, safe, as safe as you can be in the green zone in Baghdad at the time, and he had a hard time understanding how I could possibly spin out these stories as so. Just potentially fraught as they were.
But was that your imagination? Those were your feelings? I mean, that's kind of where your mind goes when
sure.
your husband, in this case, is at war.
Yeah.
Or in a war zone.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a different experience for the person who's there and the person who's not.
And I'm curious, I read about the fact that obviously you and your husband would communicate with each other. And I know it's also difficult to communicate when someone is so far away and in such a fraught part of the world. How much do you think those conversations sort of work their way into the poems?
I mean, a fair amount. We spoke on the phone a little bit until we realized just how ridiculously expensive it was. And also the connections were pretty bad and the time zone was hard to work around. I was in class and he was, you know, it would be the middle of his night. But we, after a while, we realized because he was lucky to have an internet connection. And so we instant messaged, you know, maybe 4 or 5 times a week. And so, yeah, a lot of the time, a lot of mornings, we would sit down and we'd be instant messaging and, you know, he would have to go back to work or I would have to go to school or something, but I would have the screenshots saved. And so it was, those are the fragments that, those were the scraps of material that initially sort of launched me into these poems.
And I guess the phone connection was so difficult, or as you say, your schedules were so sort of unconnected. It was hard to talk, because I would think it'd be hard not to hear that person's voice.
Yeah, although it's hard not to have that human connection. But at the same time, when you have that human connection, it's also, you know, it's maybe equally fraught. Like, you know, you have a couple of minutes, and there's the human, but it's. But the other person is sort of stripped of, you know, you're still dealing with the distance, and in some ways it's easier if you're not reminded of that, you know, very humanness, like in whispering in your ear.
Your husband was actually interviewed by one of the reporters here, Susan Phillips, and he has such a different, interesting experience of these poems, basically saying that didn't happen to me, you know, that what you describe in these poems is not his experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think he is understandably wary of the way that he is sort of thrust into the spotlight. And I think as sort of general readers, we want to read autobiography from this. And it's not. I mean, it can't be. It's, for one, it's a poem, and yes, it's not his. And even if it were his, it still wouldn't be, you know, honest to the quote unquote facts. But, you know, at the same time, they come from experiences. They come from my experience of his experience, and so there's a fair amount of, a non-writer might call it liberties. It's poetry.
Yes.
So,
and you're allowed to do that.
Yes. Yeah. You are allowed.
But it seemed like what he was saying, he didn't want people to think that he was in more danger than perhaps these poems put him in.
You know what I mean? Yeah, and I mean, these were exceptions. These were general exceptions to his mm-hmm. perception of safety over the course of that year. But yeah, I mean, nobody wants to be seen as sort of more heroic than they are, I think. Yeah. And it's a sensitive issue.
You wrote a piece a couple of years ago, for the New York Times, about being a quote-unquote war bride, which is such a... I mean, in some ways, it's an old-fashioned way of thinking about war and marriage, but it also is very provocative. War bride.
Yeah, and I think I apply it to myself sort of with tongue-in-cheek, because it is. It feels like an antiquated term, and anybody who knows me, I was sort of an unsuspecting war bride. We literally... got married and didn't tell anybody about it. And
you got married long distance. I mean, through the
yeah,
the FedEx,
essentially,
right?
Essentially, yeah. But it is. I mean, you know, I do feel a certain connection or solidarity with, you know, the World War II mm-hmm. era war brides. Although it was a different culture.
Sure,
it's a different world now.
And in this article, you describe, and this kind of picks up a little bit of what you were saying earlier about how the military would tell war brides, you know, keep it light. Don't burden your husband with what might be going on at home, and the kind of responsibility of being a war bride.
Yeah, it's wild. And I don't remember where exactly that article came from, but I remember like stumbling across it on the internet. It was kind of a good housekeeping tone. But it wasn't old. It was contemporary. It was, you know, that was sort of the advice on what you do when your partner is deployed. And it just, you know, it seemed laughable. That was, you know, we hadn't updated our notions of that role, of that experience.
But I could also understand, if I were a war bride, the desire to want to protect, you know, my husband, if he were in harm's way in some way with what might be troubling me at home. I mean, I would think that impulse is sort of a natural one to have.
I guess. You know, I feel
you're
like
shaking
we're,
your head.
Yeah, more
not.
Than anything, like, I think we would rather level with each other. And I think that we would feel betrayed in some way if we weren't.
If you weren't honest with what was actually going on in your life. Yeah, which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to have you actually read another poem, and this one is called Gratitude. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about sort of where this poem came from, because, again, it's beautiful and provocative.
Yeah, thanks. So this is actually the first poem of the book, and it was one of the earlier poems in the book. And I wanted to begin the book itself with gratitude, with the concept of gratitude, this just the the notion of being grateful from kind of from the beginning in this book that is in part about being, you know, witnessing some forms of terror. And the poem, it came from, I think it might have actually come from a phone conversation we had. And there are some, there's maybe a fragment or two of the original language. But this was, you know, this is what I heard of his narrative.
I'd love to have you read it.
Okay. In gratitude. Wreckage was still smoldering on the airport road when they delivered the soldier, beyond recognition, seeing God's hands in the medevac's spun rotors, to the station's gravel landing pad. By the time you arrived, there were already hands fluttering white flags of gauze against the ruptured scaffolding of ribs, the glistening skull, and no skin left untended, so you were the one to sink the rubber catheter tube. When you tell me this over the phone, hours later, I can hear rotors scalping the tarmac gray sky, the burdenless lift of your voice. And I love you more for holding the last good flesh of that soldier's in your hands, for startling his warm blood back to life. Listen, I know the way the struck cord begins to shudder, fierce heat rising into the skin of my own sensate palms. That moment just before we think the end will never come, and then the moment when it does.
And that's Elise Fenton reading from the beginning, the beginning poem in her collection of poetry called Clamor, and that's a poem called Gratitude. And again, your use of language here is so powerful, and also this imagery. I mean, we go from death to sex. Within really a couple of lines.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's actually I took a class in grad school, and I think I took the class after I'd written this poem, but it was called Sex and Death. Because you know, I think in poetry and also in the world, there's a lot of overlap between that material and especially in the position of the, you know, the quote unquote war bride.
Yes.
These are kind of two, you know, fundamental human things that occupy minds.
And I'm wondering, as you say, you know, many liberties in this poem, but I wonder, you know, was your husband the one to sink the rubber catheter tube?
Why, yes.
Okay,
he was. He did sink the rubber catheter tube, you know, which is, you know, not a heroizing detail.
But sort of, I mean, it's the medicine, the war, the death, and then, as I say, the sort of sexual sensuality of as well.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's a common question. People are like, well, okay, but what was actually true?
Exactly.
But what, you know, I want to know why, you know, why is that the question? What difference would that make in a reading?
Well, from my perspective would be, because I know that these poems came from your experience of being here and having a husband who was in a war zone. And I think, you know, part of at least a reader or listener or viewer sort of wants to understand how does that person fit into this experience? Obviously, knowing in poetry or fiction or in film, great liberties can be taken, mm-hmm. but sort of wanting to know sort of it, within all this fiction, you know, is there something that's true that actually did happen that I can sort of understand?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, we're gluttons for
we are.
Authenticity. And,
we are.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's sort of navigating those questions and navigating in poetry. Cause you know, as a poet, you know, I'd say, well, what, I'm not even going to answer that question. why does that matter?
Of course.
How does that change your reading
experience?
How does
course.
That change the composition of the piece? And it doesn't. But I understand that this is, you know, this collection is reaching different audiences and it's, you know, it's kind of it's a human interest story. It's timely. And I'm glad for that.
Yeah. And we are at war. I mean, that's the other thing too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If only, you know, if only because this is sort of bringing the attention of people back to both wars that, you know, we are still fighting. And I think that I've lived in relatively, you know, polarized places. And I think that as a reminder, this is crucial.
That That was my 2011 conversation with poet Elise Fenton about her debut collection of poems called Clamor. And that wraps up the Radio Times Memorial Day special. Thank you so much for joining us. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Alex Stern, and John Ahrens, who edited the show today. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thanks for joining us.